This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. May is always race month in Charlotte, but May 2010 marks a point where every month has become race month with the opening of the NASCAR Hall of Fame. And that is where we are today, broadcasting live from the Great Hall, the main hall of the Hall of Fame. And we'll spend the hour learning about NASCAR, about how they put all this together, about some of the things you can see and do when you visit. We'll take you on a ride in a simulated race car and challenge some visitors to become members of a pit crew. And we begin with a big name in racing, especially if you have ever watched or listened to a race. Winston Kelly is the lead pit reporter with the Motor Racing Network and is also the executive director of the National Association for Stock Car Auto Racing NASCAR Hall of Fame. I've never heard it set out that way, but Winston, welcome back to the program.
Delighted to be here and appreciate WFAE and NPR being here as a part of the NASCAR Hall of Fame opening weeks.
It's an amazing building. I've spent a couple of hours here already this week just walking around and looking at things, and coming from the point of view of somebody who, and I hate to say this in front of you, who's not necessarily a fan, I get it now. I get it.
Well, and there's no reason to apologize. I've gotten that for years. People that I work with in the business community say, you know, I'm not necessarily a NASCAR fan. Well, that's okay. I'm not a hunter. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I like to listen to people who might hunt and learn about that. And one of our objectives here is to have something for everybody, not just the diehard NASCAR fan, which we have things for them, a lot of immersive artifacts, but for people like yourself who wouldn't consider themselves NASCAR fans, so they can interact, our over 50 interactors, so people can really understand the sport. And just like any other business, there's a lot more to it than just cars going around in circles.
Right. Absolutely, and you learn that very quickly when you walk through all the exhibits here. This building, the building itself, is stunning. I mean, as you walk, just seeing it from the outside, it's an incredible addition to the city of Charlotte. But inside, it is stunning, too. And it looks like a technological marvel. That was obviously deliberate.
It absolutely was. You know, we wanted something that had architectural grandeur, but the real meat and potatoes, if you will, what's going to bring guests back time and again, is what's inside. And we had a fabulous exhibit design group led by Ralph Applebaum and Associates and the folks at the City of Charlotte, Kathleen Drake and the team there, and our exhibit design team, who you'll talk to later with Buzz McKim and Kevin Schleser. And we really tried to focus on having an in-depth, immersive experience into NASCAR, the technology that you mentioned with over 50 interactives. People like seeing the artifacts, but people want to touch, feel, learn how it works, learn how things are done behind the scenes. Things like you reference, how they change tires. You know, I've covered this sport for a long time. I tend to take for granted that they can change four tires, put in 18 gallons of fuel, and make adjustments to the car in 12.5 to 13.5 seconds. Most people can't take off and put on five lug nuts in that time.
Right.
And I can't either. You know, and that's one of the things that one of our experiences that you can compete against folks, and we've got kids' experiences for things like that. So a 5-year-old has something to do just like a 15-year-old or a 55-year-old.
If I met you on the street and didn't know who you were, I wouldn't take you for a NASCAR fan. And you've been the vice president of a bank and things like that. So when did you first get attracted to the sport?
I grew up in the sport. My father was involved, and I tell people my English teacher would hate this, but I've never not known NASCAR.
Mm-hmm.
My first race was in 1964. Richard Petty drove a car very similar to the one that we'll talk about to the Daytona 500 win, but my father was the first public relations director at the Charlotte Motor Speedway, and then when he went into business for himself, he did a lot of broadcasting on the old Universal Racing Network.
Uh-huh.
So if your dad hunts and fishes, you tend to hunt
That's
fish.
Right.
I tagged along with Dad to the racetrack and always wanted to get involved. And, you know, when I got involved back in the early 80s, you couldn't make a living broadcasting races back then. And, you know, I'd never tried driving, but got involved on the radio side and public address system side. So I've always been around it.
10,000 people or so have been through this building since it opened a week ago. Is that a good thing? Are you pleased with the numbers?
You know, it's a very good start. You know, and we haven't looked at it from a micro standpoint. You know, how many people are going to come in a week or in a day? We'll look at it more over time. But since we opened up prior to race season and during school season was still in and end of grade testing was still going on, we think it's a very solid number. And the thing that we're most excited about is the feedback that we have gotten.
I'll bet.
That people Absolutely love it. After the Sprint Pit Crew Challenge last night, I spent probably over 30 minutes talking to three couples, two of whom were from Connecticut and one from Texas, that were just so enamored with everything that was in here.
Yeah.
And just had a great time listening to their stories and telling them stories about what's in here, but also talking to the people like yourself that said, you know, not been around this sport, but, man, I really get it,
yeah.
And I want to come back,
yeah.
And that's what excites us.
Because there's so much to see. And I said in the opening minute, which you don't hear on this program because we're engaged in conversation doing that, that this is literally a Disney World for NASCAR fans. And the building is very much like a Disney World exhibit because you get introduced by a movie. It's about a 12-minute movie in a beautiful theater. And like everything else in NASCAR, the seats are sponsored by Belk. but you get introduced to the whole thing with a movie, and then you come out into Glory Road, and then you go through the exhibits. It's a really interesting way to introduce people.
Well, Mike, people would think we may have scripted this, which we actually didn't. You know, one of the things I've said over the last 4 years as we've gone and addressed groups, be it Rotaries or other type of organizations, is when people say, how are things going down at the NASCAR Museum, I want to say, I don't know. I don't work at a museum. But because we've got a multifaceted facility, we are part museum,
right,
with close to 1,000 artifacts. That's the very museum-rich part, which is up on Heritage Speedway. But we also are part entertainment attraction, and mm-hmm. we've used Disney and Carowinds as kind of the correlation with all the interactive activities that we have throughout the facility. And we're part theater. You mentioned that.
Right.
And we've got our big Belk High Octane Theater that starts off the experience, but there's four other smaller theater-like experiences, not to mention our huge fan billboard here in the Great Hall. And I think we've probably got about 75 different kiosks that have various videos. So we've got that aspect as well. So we're part museum, part theater, part entertainment attraction, and part, just a good experience for people to come from a family perspective.
Well, we've been standing in the middle of the Great Hall, and now we're walking, we're wireless, amazing. We're walking toward Glory Road. Glory Road is what?
It tells a couple of stories. You know, everything in here tells a story. While a lot of things are hands-on and interactive, that they tell stories as well. But the Great Hall tells two stories. One is the track story. It starts out flat and gently goes up to the next level and banks up to 33 degrees.
We should point out that the big curve in this building that you see from the outside, that's part of Glory Road, and you have cars set on a track, and the track, as it goes up the hill, becomes more and more and more banked. And you're allowed to walk on it.
Absolutely.
And it's almost impossible to
walk on. And that's a great visual depiction that you gave, Mike, that when you come by here on Martin Luther King Boulevard at the corner of MLK and Brevard Street, and you look in and you see the curved area, you are looking into Glory Road.
Uh-huh.
And every football field is exactly the same size. Every basketball court is exactly the same size. The fields that we play on each and every weekend are different.
Yep.
They're different sizes, they're different shapes, and they're different bankings.
And the road surface is different.
Exactly. So one of the things that you get to experience is how they start out. Some of them are flat, mm-hmm. like our road, like the road courses in Bowman Gray Stadium. The most steeply banked is the Talladega Super Speedway at 33 degrees of banking. So you can see the different banking,
right,
or the different tracks that we participate in. And as you mentioned, there's a couple of places you can walk out and actually experience the banking at 14 degrees and then again at 33 degrees. Because if you've ever been on a racetrack, it's very hard to stand up in it, and people take that for granted.
And here's how you figure it out. You put your left leg, or you put your lower leg on one step of the staircase, and then put the other leg two or three steps up, and that's the banking. It's pretty amazing. One of the other things that happens here with Glory Road is that it's a history lesson.
It's a history lesson. You mentioned the surfaces. On many of the tracks, we've got surfaces that actually came from those racetracks. Like here at Watkins Glen,
mm-hmm.
we've got the actual asphalt that came out of Watkins Glen.
Wow.
We've got concrete from some of the tracks as well. So that's one of the components. We've got all of the current NASCAR Sprint Cup, Nationwide, and Camping World Truck Series tracks represented here, and about a dozen of the historic tracks. So you get a history lesson and a current lesson.
And also a history lesson in cars, because you begin with an early car, the Byron's Ford Coupe, which what year would this be?
This would be a 1939 Ford, but it was actually raced first in 1948, the very first year of NASCAR. There's 18 cars on Glory Road, and we can change them out, and we'll change them out every couple of years and theme them different ways. So the first theme is literally as if you're walking up in time.
Right.
Of these 18 cars, 17 were the actual car that was raced in competition.
Really?
Or the chassis that had been rebuilt.
Including the Hudson?
The Hudson Hornet.
Appears,
you know,
in the movie Cars.
Exactly. You know, one of the neatest comments that I got was from a five-year-old boy that said, "So you've got Doc Hudson and Mr. the King in here."
Yeah.
And that's his point of reference. The only one that's a replica is Lee Petty's Oldsmobile that won the 1959 Daytona 500. Richard Petty and his crew rebuilt that for his father. They loaned that to us. But every other car was the actual car that was raced here. We've got a Holman and Moody car from it's one of the reasons that NASCAR is based here in Charlotte is Holman and Moody. That they were a team that started providing a lot of cars and parts back in the 50s and 60s. So we've got Fireball Roberts' car. The most successful car in NASCAR history, Richard Petty's 1967 Plymouth. He won 27 races that year, 10 in a row, and he won 9 races the previous year with that car.
Now, I was in here the other day, and I'm looking at the number 71 K&K Insurance car. Who drove that?
Bobby Isaac drove this to the 1970 Grand National Championship.
And this is a very long car, and it's got big, tall wings on it. And I was surprised to find that you could actually buy this car at retail at one point.
You could. In 1969 and 1970, Chrysler came out with the shark-nosed car that was a byproduct of a Dodge Charger and a Plymouth Roadrunner that they called a Plymouth Superbird and a Dodge Daytona. And they put this big wing on the back. And they became so superior that NASCAR made some rule changes in the following year that made
it difficult. Because they couldn't
lose. But there are clubs that actually buy and sell and show these things. So that's one of the iconic cars.
You know what is neat about this is in these early cars, you could buy these. They look exactly like the cars that people drove down the street to work every day. And now, of course, they've become race cars. You can't buy these cars. Is that something that NASCAR is happy about?
It's just something that evolved. I wouldn't say that they're unhappy with it. Cars have just evolved over time, and just like any other business, it has evolved with the technology.
Right.
But you're absolutely right. You could actually see these cars and drive them off of the showroom floor. You know, one of the other things that's interesting, we're a NASCAR Hall of Fame, not just a Cup Series, Sprint Cup or Grand National Series. So we've got one of Richie Evans' sleek modified cars that is a really unique-looking car. It's really hard to describe. We've got Jack Ingram's Pontiac from back in the 80s. We've got Ron Hornaday's championship truck from 1996. And, of course, you got to have a Dale Earnhardt car and a Jimmy Johnson and a Jeff Gordon car.
And so it goes right up to the present day
on
Glory Road.
Yeah, Jimmy Johnson's is a 2008 car from his 2008 championship. So you start with 1948, and you go 60 years later to 2008.
I got about a minute left. I want to talk very briefly about the inductees this weekend, at the original class, which would be Dale Earnhardt, Richard Petty, Junior Johnson, Bill France, and Bill France, Jr. Are most people happy with that selection? Are they ticked off that David Pearson is not going to be in there?
You know, I think David's the only one that people really thought, and I always felt like it was going to come down to those six.
Right.
I thought it was going to come down to the five that got in and David Pearson. And the way it was put to me after the vote that somebody made a comment, this class is about what they did for the sport. Next class may be about what they did in the sport. And David did a tremendous amount in the sport, but Junior and Richard and Dale and Francis did so much for the sport. And one of the things we'd encourage folks to do, to come out and be a part of our red carpet arrival. If they have a ticket to the Hall of Fame this Sunday, they can get it on NASCARHall.com. They can come in. We're going to open early at 9 o'clock, and at 11:30, there's going to be a red carpet arrival leading up to the induction ceremony.
It's like the Oscars for NASCAR. It will be like the Oscars for NASCAR. Winston Kelly, Executive Director of the NASCAR Hall of Fame, thank you for joining us. I appreciate it.
Delighted to be here.
We're coming right back. Stay with us.
You're listening to a special edition of Charlotte Talks live from the NASCAR Hall of Fame. We'll get back to the program in just a moment. It's made possible in part by Firefold, local specialist in computer, home theater, networking products, and accessories. Located just minutes from Concord Mills Mall, more information available at www.firefold.com/NPR. And by Winston-Salem State University's Master's in Healthcare Administration program, designed for professionals with a mind for business and a heart for healthcare, wssu.edu/tellmemore. Well, even George Washington once called Charlotte a trifling place, and in 1840, it was a small, unimportant town of less than 5,000 people. But a decision by city leaders connected to the railroad changed everything. We'll find out that and more with a show tomorrow about the history of trains in Charlotte. That's tomorrow on Charlotte Talks at 9.
Taliban suicide bombers take direct aim at a U.S. military base in Afghanistan one day after an attack on a NATO convoy. Challenges ahead for U.S. forces in Afghanistan. The Diane Rehm Show, Thursday.
Join us for the Diane Rehm Show this and each weekday morning right after Charlotte Talks from 10 to noon on listener-funded radio, WFAE, your NPR news source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're broadcasting live from the NASCAR Hall of Fame, which is arguably a race fan's Disney World, but it's also a legitimate museum housing many important artifacts from the sport's unique history. Putting together such a museum takes a lot of knowledge, and the NASCAR Hall of Fame found that in Buzz McKinn, who spent an hour taking us through the museum and pointing out some of racing's more significant treasures. How many square feet in this museum?
We have 150,000 square feet. 40,000 square feet of display space. So we had a lot of room to fill.
So with a lot of room to fill, I would think there's a lot of memorabilia out there, more than can fit in this building.
That's right.
How did you decide what to put in here?
Well, it's a matter of actually coming up with a script, you might say. How do we tell the story of NASCAR? Going back to the founding of NASCAR in 1947 and beyond. What led up to the founding of NASCAR? Why was it formed? And then what are some of the highlights of the organization over the last 62 years? So coming up with themed cases like we have behind us here, and we have these three different platforms that represent different eras in NASCAR history. And so coming up with that storyline, mm-hmm. All right, well, what's a great story for, say, the champions case? What are some of the champions that were great in their day but maybe folks don't know about today? So we would go after some of those items.
So we're on the fourth floor because you decided to start here.
Okay.
And you said this is a good place to start, and we're standing in front of the Union 76 emblem. Mm-hmm. So tell me why we're here.
Okay, well, this is kind of an interesting deal here. Back in 1969, Daytona Speedway commissioned a local fiberglass company to build these balls. Now, they're representative of the Union 76 logo, and they became the spotter towers for the Talladega Speedway and also for the Daytona Speedway. So there were eight of them built, one for each corner. And then you would have a spotter, or two spotters, actually, inside the ball that would watch for debris on the track and things like that. We have a little bit of a recorded version of what would have happened.
We are in the ball, and we're hearing the radio play-by-play?
That's right. Yeah, the two spotters inside the ball would be in contact with the main control tower, and they'd be watching for debris on the track. Or one year when I was working the second turn ball at Daytona, we had a fox run across the backstretch in the middle of the Daytona 500.
So is this one of the original balls?
Yes, it is. Yeah, this actually came from the third turn at Daytona.
Put it out. Turn one and two. Slow down, guys.
On this side of the hallway, we have the great families of NASCAR. We feature the Allisons, the Frances, the Earnhardts, and the Petties, and arguably the Earnhardts and the Petties are the two biggest names in the history of the sport. Well, here is a check that was made out to Ralph Earnhardt from Mrs. Lee Petty in 1957.
And written on the Scottish Bank, which used to be a bank here in Charlotte.
Oh, all right.
Yeah.
Yeah, this would have been probably the Randleman branch, most likely. You see where his taxes were deducted over here on the side. And Ralph drove a car for the Petties in several races in 1957, and he came away with $95.45. So it was the initial merging of the two greatest families in the sport.
How difficult was it to get some of these artifacts from the families, from the fans, from whoever else you got them from?
Yeah, and we did get a lot from the fans, too. The majority of the items did come from the families. But it was surprisingly I don't want to say easy, but it was a lot easier than I thought it would be. When people realized that the hall was actually coming along, there was a building. It would be huge. It would be quite a showplace. It got a little easier too when people realized that it wasn't just a hole in the ground anymore. It was an actual building. So we were very fortunate.
Was NASCAR the last major sport to get a Hall of Fame of its own?
I believe so. Yeah.
Why? What took so long?
Well, it had to develop a history, actually. Baseball was about 50, 60 years old when their Hall of Fame came online. And NASCAR had to build a history, basically. It has really become a world-class sport over the last several years with all the Fortune 500 companies coming on board. And it deserved a Hall of Fame now. You know, we have a great, rich, deep, colorful history to draw from. So now's a good time.
There are a lot of display cases, and they display everything from the suits that the drivers wore to little replica cars that are not unlike a toy. I guess they are toys.
Yeah, expensive toys.
To trophies, etc. Even a popcorn machine.
Yes.
We're standing in front of this particular case that holds that popcorn machine. What's significant about this case?
Well, this is the France family case. Bill France Sr. founded NASCAR in 1947. His son, Bill Jr., took over in 1972. And toward the later years of his life, he loved popcorn. And he had this popcorn machine moved into the break room in the NASCAR headquarters in Daytona. And every day, like clockwork, he would send his secretary down to throw some popcorn on, and everybody would share popcorn in the afternoon. You always knew when Bill was in the building because 3 o'clock there was popcorn. If you didn't smell popcorn at 3, then Bill didn't make it in that day. This side of the hallway is devoted to the fans' collections. And we wanted the fans to really feel like this is part of them. And it really is an honor to them, a tribute to them. If it wasn't for the fans, we certainly wouldn't have NASCAR.
So fans actually owned some of the race suits that the guys wore in the cars?
That's right.
How did they get them?
Well, they're fairly easy to get. A lot of them are bought at auction. Sometimes crew members inherit them from the drivers, and it goes on eBay or whatever. But there's several different ways to accumulate helmets and uniforms. Now, this was a piece of paper that we found in some items that were donated to us. We call it the Find a Thief Note. And around 1980, 1981, someone had broken into one of the trucks and had stolen some personal items from one of the teams.
Mm-hmm.
So Dick Beatty, who was the guru of the garage area, put this piece of paper up on the wall in the garage area, and he took up a collection for a fund for the apprehension and conviction of the thief. So literally everyone in the garage area, car owners, drivers, there's some on the back of the sheet that you can't see, they wrote their name down, and they pledged what they would give. And you can tell it was a long time ago because Mark Martin only pledged $50. He'd do a lot better.
Benny Parsons has signed it. He's pledged what? $100. Yeah. Cale Yarborough, $250. Yeah. Jeff Bodine, $100. Uh-huh. Terry Labonte, $100. Dale Earnhardt, $100. Bobby Allison, $250. Mm-hmm. Who's Winston?
Winston is Winston Cigarettes.
Okay. They pledged $1,000, and it says, anyone knowing or having information leading to the arrest and conviction of the person or persons involved in the thefts of personal belongings in the Grand National Garage will be paid the following amount of money contributed by the following people.
Now, if you notice right here, Darrell Waltrip signed, but instead of an amount, he wrote, depends on who it is. July 4th, 1984, mm-hmm. Richard Petty became the only driver to reach the height of 200 wins. And that was in the presence of Ronald Reagan, who was the first sitting U.S. president to attend a NASCAR event. And this is the jacket that they presented to President Reagan that day.
It has the presidential seal on the back of a blue jacket. It says Firecracker 400 on the back below the seal and United States of America on the left and right arms.
That's
of
right.
The jacket.
His name is embroidered over the heart on the front of the jacket. And
did he wear it? The president wear it?
Yes, he did. Yeah, and ironically, he was a race announcer in the 1930s.
President Reagan?
Yes, he was. In Des Moines, Iowa, at the Fairgrounds Speedway there, the old dirt track.
At WHO?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he was the old sportscaster. He was one of those guys that would do a baseball broadcast with his own sound effects, just reading it off the teletype machine. He's a man. He'd make you feel like you were right there.
Tell me he didn't do the NASCAR sounds.
No.
He didn't do...
No.
Okay,
no,
good.
No. We have a full-size still on display here. You know, NASCAR did have some roots in the untaxed adult beverage business. It was strictly by coincidence, though. But Junior Johnson, the king of all moonshiners, was contacted, and we wanted just a model of a still that we could put on display in a little cubbyhole in the corner. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, it would take me just as long to build a real one. So he built us a real still using the old family design, and he even delivered it to us. So it was in storage for about a year, and we got ready to put it together. And we had a little trouble getting from point A to point B, so I gave him a call and said, we need a little advice, so, you know, we have to do this and this, and what do you think? And he said, I couldn't really describe it to you. He said, how about if I just come on down? So about 2 hours later, he shows up in his bib overalls and a great big pair of channel locks and a gigantic pipe wrench, and he started cranking on the still. It's amazing. He claims it would work. You know, it's actually operational. Junior Johnson was caught in 1956 not running moonshine, which he was known for, but he actually went down to stoke the fire for his father early one morning. He had just won a race the night before in Pennsylvania. He came home, his father asked him to go ahead and get the fire going, and he got nailed by the revenuer. So he did 11 months and 3 days in Chillicothe, Ohio, was released in late 1957, and in 1985, President Ronald Reagan gave him a presidential pardon, and he says it was the proudest moment of his life, and it's the number one most important item in his entire life. We have five statues here that represent the five most prominent founders of NASCAR. 1947, Bill France brought the best drivers, mechanics, car owners, promoters to Daytona to hammer out a uniform set of rules and a national point fund, and it became NASCAR. So here we have Bill France Sr. as he appeared in 1947. His former secretary was here the other day, and she said his feet are too small. And then we have Bill Tuthill, who was a Northeastern promoter who was an exceptional businessman. So between Tuthill and France, they really made it work. We have Red Vogt, who was the fellow who came up with the name NASCAR. He was the first superstar mechanic of the sport. And then Red Byron, his driver, who won the first NASCAR race and the first two NASCAR championships. But the fellow in the middle here with the suit and the hat is Raymond Parks. And Raymond owned the cars that Vogt and Byron raced. He was also a multimillionaire from Atlanta. He made his first million by the time he was 21 years old, came out of the hills of North Georgia. He did real good. So Raymond will be here for the induction on Sunday. He'll be 96 years old June the 6th, and he's the last surviving founding member of NASCAR.
Is there anything that you look at as being the most significant artifact in the museum, or one that's pivotal to the history of NASCAR?
Yes, I would think it would be this piece of paper right here. This right here in this glass case is the rule book, quote unquote, the first one of NASCAR for the 1948 season. It's a single sheet of about legal size paper with printing on both sides. So it started out rather simple back in the day, but this is the key to what NASCAR was all about. Racing was a very unorganized, kind of a ragtag deal as far as stock car racing goes. The Indianapolis racing was fairly clean, and stock car racing had a lot of unscrupulous promoters back then. They'd take off with the money while the guys are out there racing. There was no uniform rules. There was no true champion, and that's what Bill France felt that he could accomplish by having everybody work together. And if you had a car in Connecticut and I had a car in Georgia, we could compete against each other because of the rules. We would run for the same points. We would go for the same national championship. And to me, that's one of the more significant things right there, is to have everybody agree on the rules. And NASCAR certainly has come about in a big way since then.
I'm surprised, given how many rules changes there are in NASCAR, that they're actually printed.
Yes. Oh, yeah. Well, some folks said that they should be written in pencil.
Yes.
But NASCAR is all about parity, having everybody as equal and putting on as close a race as you possibly can have. And if they find that one make of car is getting an advantage, then they have to look at the rules and they have to bring everybody back together.
For those people who don't know, why the France family? Why are they so pivotal? Why were they the ones that actually got it started? Surely there were other people out there at the time who could have just just as easily started it.
Well, you know, Bill was a rather imposing figure. He was 6'5", extremely charismatic, good-looking, and he was a born leader. And he had a way of just gathering people around him and instilling incredible loyalty. That was a big plus. He also was known for his honesty, his integrity, and that was a huge plus in racing in those days. But he started out as a mechanic in Washington, D.C., where he was born. In 1933, he decided he was tired of working on the cars in the cold. He decided to move to Daytona Beach. There were some relatives in the area. It'd be nice and warm. Daytona had a great racing history, and Bill was involved in the local racing scene around the Washington, D.C. area before then. So he got involved in the racing scene around Daytona. And when they staged the first stock car race on the beach in 1936, Bill entered the race, came in fifth. The city lost $20,000 on that race. So the Elks Club, local Elks Club, took over the 1937 race. They said, we'll put that race on. Well, they lost everything. The winner won like $43. The guy who came in 16th won three pairs of socks. You know, some of those deals. So in 1938, they couldn't find a promoter for the race because the racing at Daytona was pretty much considered a, you know, white elephant. So the guru of all race promoters wintered just to the west of Daytona. It was about a 25-cent phone call or a toll call to Ralph Hankinson. Bill France figured, I'm a racer. We got to keep racing on the beach. We got to keep this, you know, this tradition alive. They've been racing here since 1903. So he called Collect to Hankinson to talk him into promoting the race because he knew it would be a success if Hankinson promoted. Hankinson didn't know who Bill France was. He refused the phone call. So Bill was complaining to a friend of his named Charlie Reese, who was a nightclub owner, bootlegger, had a lot of money. He said, well, let's form a partnership. You do the legwork, I'll put the money up, let's see what happens. So they ended up splitting a $200 profit. And Bill realized that, wow, this is pretty neat. So he continued his driving through 1946, but he also started developing his promotional skills. He retired from driving in 46, realized how big racing could be if it was organized, brought the guys together in 47, founded NASCAR. Now it's a multi-billion dollar empire because of a 25-cent phone call that wasn't accepted in 1938.
There's no question, Buzz McKim, that you are a walking encyclopedia of NASCAR history, and you're described here at the Hall of Fame as being the historian. How does one get to be the NASCAR historian?
Reading a lot, not having much of a life. No, I'm just kidding. I was so fortunate, just like with Winston Kelly, our executive director, I was born into the sport. Both our fathers were involved in the sport, and it just became a part of us. And I was fortunate that most everything I saw or read, I just retained. My wife said if we had studied the stock, or if I'd studied the stock market, we'd be a lot better off, but I don't know. It wouldn't have been as much fun. But when we moved to Daytona Beach in 1965, we ended up living right down the street from Bill Tuthill, the fellow with the statue, and his Museum of Speed. So my brother and I would run down there every day after school, every weekend. We'd hang around, we'd clean the cars, we'd listen to Tuthill's stories, and it just, the history of the sport just became ingrained in us.
Let me ask you this, because you bring up an interesting point. Anybody of our generation who was interested in something was able to hang around and soak it up like a sponge and be around adults who are in it. Does that exist in NASCAR today? Can a kid hang around these drivers, hang around these race teams, and learn and suck it up like a sponge?
Well, they might not be able to hang around today's drivers because they're harder to get to. But there are enough of the older folks around, even the last generation of drivers, the Darrell Waltrips and people like that, that they can still have access to. And there's a fellow named Cody Dinsmore. He reminds me so much of myself. He's 12 years old, and he goes to all the Legends gatherings. He is the next encyclopedia. And he retains everything he sees, and I can see him becoming a historian one day. It's kind of scary. He's a lot better looking than I was at that age, but he's a brilliant kid, and he has this passion for the history of the sport. And I'm glad to see the younger folks take an interest, and hopefully we can instill interest in the younger folks and the newer fans through the Hall of Fame here.
NASCAR Hall of Fame historian Buzz McKim. And when we come back, we meet the man who turned all of that history into colorful, compelling, and sometimes interactive exhibits. Stay with us as we continue Charlotte Talks live from the NASCAR Hall of Fame.
Back to this special edition of Charlotte Talks live at the NASCAR Hall of Fame in just a moment. It's made possible in part by McCall Center for Visual Art, now registering the Summer Arts Institute for Children, grades 1st through 8th, week-long visual art classes, June 14th through August 6th. Class listings at McCallCenter.org. And by Community Blood Center of the Carolinas, we all have the power to heal. It's in our blood. Blood plays an essential role in the lives of local patients being treated for cancer, heart disease, trauma, and organ transplants. CBCC.us. Coming up on the Diane Rehm Show at 10 o'clock, Taliban suicide bombers take direct aim at a U.S. military base in Afghanistan one day after an attack on a NATO convoy. Challenges ahead for American forces in Afghanistan. We are live at the NASCAR Hall of Fame on Charlotte Talks. We'll get back to that conversation in just a moment.
WFAE keeps you informed about important issues in our community.
Municipalities have been receiving 100% funding from the public libraries, and the reality is we just can't afford that anymore.
What do you mean they've been receiving 100% public funding?
In other words, Mid-Hill, Matthews, Davidson, we have not been receiving any direct funding.
Brandstrom says if the library loses half...
90.7 WFAE is your trusted source for news.
We are live from the NASCAR Hall of Fame here on Charlotte Talks on WFAE. I'm Mike Collins. You may have a lot of history at your fingertips and even collected thousands of artifacts, but displaying them in a way that makes sense and engages visitors is a special challenge. And I can tell you from having toured the Hall of Fame that Kevin Sleaser met that challenge. He is the exhibit manager here, responsible for the long-term planning of events. He is also a lifetime car enthusiast, although he tells me, we'll talk about this, he did nothing about NASCAR when this all started, and he assisted in the development of the Route 66 portion of the Smithsonian Institution's National Museum of American History exhibition before he became the head dude here with regard to the exhibits. And that exhibition at the Smithsonian was called America on the Move, and Kevin Sleaser, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning, Mike.
You really knew nothing about NASCAR when you were given the job of putting all this together?
I knew very little. I had read some things between interviewing, getting the job, and actually showing up on day one. But in terms of my background in NASCAR, I grew up on Long Island, which now that I've worked here, I know that we have a great history of tracks, Islip, Riverhead, things like that. But just was never exposed to that. Grew up around collector cars. We had a yard full of cars at one point, and we restored them, worked on them, lived and breathed with them, but never got to the track and really never got immersed into NASCAR. So I actually knew it tacitly through my daughter, who loved the movie Cars. That was my major experience and my major education about NASCAR.
So now that it's up and running, all the exhibits are in place, your work is done. What do you do every day?
Oh, hardly. Every day we do a lot of different things just to make sure that everything's working, operational. We check the interactives. We actually do surveys almost daily just to take a look at the artifacts that we have on display. Is everything still where it needs to be in terms of its condition? Is everything looking okay? We've got a lot of paper documents. So the collections manager, Michelle Leopold, and myself, we look at things regularly. We make sure that, you know, the great thing about Glory Road is that our guests can get up close and personal to these cars. But one of the things that we need to do is make sure, have they gotten a little bit too close and maybe a little bit too personal?
Yeah, because one of the things that all museums, and part of this building is a museum, and they all struggle with, is that people naturally want to touch
things. They do.
And in this museum, you're encouraged to touch some of the things,
not all
of them. So the things that people touch, you've got to keep up with, right?
That's right. You know, we have several vehicles on display in our Food Line Race Week area that are modern Sprint Cup Series cars that our guests can go right up to. They can stick their face right up into the window nets or in the windows, take a look around. They can put their hands on them. And we encourage that. And it's a great way for our guests to get really close to something that might be blazing past them at 180 miles an hour normally.
Right.
They can get really close and really see the different components in the technology. And what we do is, you know, we just take a look. We make sure, is there any damage on them? You know, we dust them off and polish them and get fingerprints off. The good thing about that is that the cars today are really robust, and unless somebody really goes out of their way to do something, they hold up really well to our guests.
How many exhibits are there in this hall at any given time?
There are approximately 1,000 artifacts within the hall, and then we chunk those out into different themes. So we have got Glory Road that has 18 vehicles. We have the Great Hall display that has 8 trophies and 2 vehicles. Then you go upstairs into Heritage Speedway, and that's where the bulk of our historic material, ranging from documents to patches to uniforms to trophies, you know, that's where the numbers really start to add up in Heritage Speedway in terms of specific artifacts.
And you have more artifacts than you have on display at any one given time.
That's right. Folks were really generous to us throughout the entire process. You know, some museums start out with great collections.
Mm-hmm.
And then they determine what do they want to show, and they develop these themes. We started out with great themes and stories, and then we made phone calls, and you know, we sent letters, and we said, what do you all have out there in the community, the fans, the race community, drivers, and things like that? And folks sent us things, and sometimes they would send us 10, 12 different items, and we maybe displayed one or two. So we, you know, the lenders let us hold on to some of them. We can display them in the future.
So you'll be changing the exhibits over time.
That's
not
right.
Going to be static.
No, not at all. We really are going to change not only artifacts within cases, we'll change entire cases and themes over so that we can keep things fresh and visitors coming back.
You know, NASCAR is all about movement. It's all about speed. Why? It's all about racing. And it would seem to me that people who come here want to get a sense of that movement all the time.
Yep.
Even this Glory Road Hall, although the cars are stationary, they look like they could move at any second because of the way the hall is designed. And you also have a number of race car simulators so that fans could actually try their hand at racing. I drove one. And so it's terrible.
Did you do as well as me the first time?
It's terrible. I hit the wall in the first 5 seconds. And Tim Ross, one of our producers, drove one. He beat my time. So before we talk about this, let's listen to Tim's wild ride.
Whoa! That was a bad wreck. I'm going through the infield, though. The crowd is roaring. And now I'm in the grass. See if I can get back on the track here. I'm now spinning donuts in the infield. But the crowd loves it. I'm 2 laps down. I went a little bit too fast before it was green flag racing. But yeah, when you hit the wall, man, you can feel it. You feel it jolt your side. And I think I actually felt it jolt the side that I hit. It was pretty lifelike. And you also get an idea of how just the tiniest turn on the wheel really moves the car. I cannot imagine doing this with 43 other cars on the track. I just don't know how they do it. I really don't. It must take amazing hand-eye coordination to do this. I mean, just amazing. And how in the world they save the car when they get a little bit sideways. And a lot of those guys can do that. It's, man, you get a feel for how tough this really is. I'm sitting in a simulator and I'm sweating. But I still think I'm going to beat Mike's time. Whoa! 157 miles an hour. When you downshift to go on the curves, you can feel every bump, you can almost feel a G-force. Oh my gosh, these guys do this for 500 miles with those heavy suits on and those big helmets. How in the world do they... Whoa! Oh, I hit the wall, but I came off of it. Woo! That was a ride. And I beat Mike Collins. About 5 seconds.
Which is why we let his piece of tape on the air and not mine. It was embarrassing. It was really challenging to do that. And he said he was sweating while he did it. So was I. You really feel like you're in the car, on the track, racing. How accurate is it?
It's incredibly accurate. The software is provided by iRacing, and it's an online racing software. So people around the world actually race competitively in this software system, and you can tweak the car and set it up. You know, when you get really deep in the weeds on it, you can set the car up exactly how they might set it up for a specific track. You know, do you need more brakes at Bristol, less brakes at Daytona? You can make all these myriad of adjustments to make yourself more competitive, just like the drivers and the teams do out at the tracks.
Kevin Sleasure is our guest. He's the exhibits manager here at the NASCAR Hall of Fame. When you go into that simulator exhibit, you have to use something called a hard card.
Card, yes.
Which is what you get when you get your admission ticket to come in here. And you use these hard cards at various different exhibits. You put the card in like a credit card, and you do whatever it is you want to do, and then you take it out. What's the purpose of the card?
Well, the main thing about NASCAR, you know, you had mentioned that we are in one part a museum, that we display artifacts and text in a very traditional sort of manner. But the real sort of crux of the sport is the technology and all the different decisions that teams have to do. And really, NASCAR is a hands-on experience.
Right.
And we want to give that hands-on experience to our guests as much as possible. So as many artifacts as we have interactive experiences. And one of the things that the hard card does is that it allows you to personalize your experience and track your score. So if you didn't do so well in the simulator, but you did really well at the strategy interactive where you learn how to set up a car, you know, by the end of your visit here, it'll determine, you know, you're not a great driver, sorry, but you're a really great mechanic or an engineer or different things like that.
Right.
So you personalize your experience. You put in your name and your email address and all these different things. You then go around to the different kiosks and you put your card down. It welcomes you back. And, it, you know, if you've done the experience already, it tells you what your score was.
Uh-huh.
And if you haven't done the experience yet, you go through it and it tells you what your points are.
And someone told me that you can go home and
yes.
access it on the Internet.
Yep. You go to NASCARHall.com/hardcard and you put in your name and the code that's on the back of your card. And then it reminds you of how well or how poorly
right.
maybe on the simulator
you
did.
You proved to all your friends
yes.
how well you did. And see, it looks right there on the Internet.
I'm a great driver, or I'm a great crew chief, or I'm a great mechanic.
There's also an opportunity for people to go and broadcast either radio or television or both. A race. You can be the race announcer. I didn't do that for fear that I might fail miserably and be cast out of here for forever. When you were collecting things, when you were assembling the collection, what was the criteria? Did you just take anything that people brought to you, or did you have certain things that you absolutely knew you needed to have? You maybe didn't know where they were, or maybe you did and you went after that. How did it happen? How did it come together?
It was a great relationship between sort of hopes and dreams and reality.
Mm-hmm.
So you go out there, we went armed with these themes and these stories. Obviously, you know, we just heard from Buzz McKim, and he had this wealth of knowledge, and he also had this knowledge of what physically existed out there.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a way to dovetail the stories that we wanted to tell that we developed with our exhibit designer and developer, Ralph Applebaum Associates. And then we went out and we made those phone calls and we looked for artifacts. And sometimes the things that you really hope exist has been lost to time.
Yeah.
You know, you can't save everything, and you would go to a driver and you'd hope for a car or something like that, and it was lost to time. But they might have something else that was equally as impressive, and we could swap different things in and out.
When we were walking with the Winston Kelly on Glory Road earlier in the program, we were looking at all these race cars, and we're still looking at them, as a matter of fact, and they're in pristine condition, even though some of them are very, very old. So as you walk through the museum and you see these artifacts, particularly the cars, you know, these cars, some of them were probably torn up pretty badly in the course of a race. Do you fix them up so they look like they did at the start of the race, or do you leave them in the condition that they were when the race was over?
It's really up to the lender. We don't touch any artifacts in terms of really restoration. The only thing that we will do is do some conservation work to make sure they don't deteriorate any further while they're in our possession. So the cars and the artifacts that you see here, for the most part, are in the exact condition that the lender handed them over to us.
And is that the way you want them? I mean,
yes.
I watch Antiques Roadshow, and you don't want to repair anything.
Right. The word patina has become, you know, this word that everybody talks about just because of that show. And a lot of the cars do have a certain patina. The Jeff Gordon car, for example, has not been touched since it came off the racetrack.
Okay.
That still has the road rubber on it. Whereas other cars, you know, they were used over and over and over again. So the chassis is original and the drivetrain is original, but they were rebodied for the next race. Forget about, you know, 40 years later.
These are so original that one of these race cars has a drip pan under it.
It does. You know, it's I was actually joking with my father back in New York, and he goes, "How are the cars holding up?" I said, "Well, believe it or not, the one car that's leaking, of course, is a 39 Ford." And he said, "Of course it is." You know, so it's going to be the 39 Ford that leaves a little bit of oil on the ground.
Well, NASCAR is having their pit road challenge this week in advance of race week for the professionals. And so since that's going on, I think it's important to point out that pit road challenges happen all day, every day here at the NASCAR Hall of Fame.
We thought it would be fun to follow three ordinary people through a pit challenge, which is where you can jack the car up, change the tire, put the car back on, fill it up with gasoline, take the car back down to the ground, and race it off. Who do we got here?
I am Chris.
Where are you from?
I am from here in Charlotte.
Okay, and you are?
I'm Tom.
I'm Pam.
Have you ever been on a pit crew before, Pam?
No.
Ever changed the tire before?
No.
All right, we're going to put you through your paces. We have a race car here, and it's ready to be worked on. Let's go. 3, 2, 1, go! Jacking the car up. Taking off the lug nuts. Car's been filled with gas. The tire's been changed. And she releases it. Oh, she didn't turn it. Oh, my gosh. She thought the thing is still up. Well, it would have been 18 seconds. It's 24 seconds. And this is the second time you've been through this. Was it better this time or worse?
18 seconds would have been better, but we had a jack mishap, kind of like last weekend. So
now are you set to change your own tire?
Operator error.
Are you set to change your own tire?
Yeah, I think okay. I am.
All right. Not on our car.
That's a lot of fun, actually, and there are people standing around watching these folks do this, and there are all kinds of ways to do this. Many different pit stop stations, and you don't have to wait in line. There are five or six of these, and there's the same thing for children as well. They can take their hand, try their hand at something smaller than this, right?
That's right. One of the things that we do really successfully here in the Hall of Fame is that we target all sorts of different guests. We're going to have our expert fans. We're going to have people that work within the industry just because we're based in Charlotte. We're going to have people that come straight from a race shop after work and come here. Mm-hmm. So we want to offer something for them, mm-hmm. as well as folks like me that didn't know a lot about the sport but are curious about it. And one of the things that we also do is target different age groups. So we have the pit stop for adults that has the full-size jack and the tire and everything like that, but we also have two stations that have a gas can, a tire, and a jack for children to use.
And although it's different, some of these challenges are really hard.
It's a hard sport.
It gives you a real idea of what this is like.
It is.
How amazing it is that they can do this in four tires in 12 seconds or less. It's amazing. One of the exhibits in the building is so large that you built the building around it.
That's right. We have a 53-foot hauler that we loaded into the building before the rest of the structural steel was built. And the hauler basically is the locker room for the teams at the track.
Mm-hmm.
They bring two cars, extra engines, transmissions, all the parts that they need throughout the race weekend. They're not going to drive all the way back to their shop in Concord if they're at a race in Tennessee. They need to be prepared for any sort of situation that could happen during qualifying, during practice, during the race. So they bring all these things in their 53-foot hauler. So, of course, we wanted to have that in the Hall of Fame that visitors can walk through.
Right.
And so we loaded that in, we rigged it, and lifted it onto the third floor before the rest of the building was built.
Wow. What exhibit are you most excited about or most proud of in the whole building?
I'm really proud of the way that the artifact exhibits interrelate with the interactives. I think it's a great relationship between that museum-style learning that you were talking about earlier and that real hands-on learning. And I think it's really appropriate for this sport, for NASCAR, to honor its heritage and its history through really prized possessions, but also acknowledge just the excitement and the engagement of the sport. So that's what I'm the most proud of, is that relationship.
Have your buddies from the Smithsonian come down here to see this, or do they just gig you for it?
I haven't had them down here for this yet, but looking forward to getting down here as soon as possible.
Kevin Sleasure is the exhibits manager here at the NASCAR Hall of Fame. We want to thank everybody involved with the Hall of Fame for helping us make this program possible. We spent a lot of time here getting ready for this, and they've been very, very helpful. And when they have their big Hall of Fame induction ceremony, the people who produced the Oscars red carpet ceremony are producing the red carpet ceremony here.
That's right.
This is uptown.
This is a big deal.
All right. Thank you for joining us. I appreciate
it. Thank you very much, Mike.
Thanks for listening.